discussed in my weekly show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Daniel, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You know about tipping points, where natural states enter unstoppable change. From disappearing glaciers to ocean current flips, tipping points keep scientists up at night. We may not know critical change happens except in the rearview mirror of time. Here is such a hidden case. In 2003, tens of thousands of Europeans died in a heat wave beyond anything seen before. We did not know that at the same time a heat wave killed and changed ocean life in the North Atlantic. This single event changed everything from tiny crabs to giant whales. Marine heat waves are getting bigger, hotter, and longer as we heat up the world. Could another defining marine heat wave be on the way? We go to the new paper, Major Heat Wave in the North Atlantic Had Widespread and Lasting Impacts on Marine Life. The lead author is Dr. Carl Michael Werner, research scientist at the Thunen Institute of Sea Fisheries in Bremerhaven, Germany. From Bremerhaven, Carl Michael Werner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex, and good evening from Germany.
Just as an introduction, how would you describe the marine heat wave of 2003?
The marine heat wave of 2003 was widespread, and it covered large parts of the subpolar North Atlantic. And just as an example, from southeast Greenland, the August temperatures there switched from around usually 5 to 6 degrees to 7 to 8 degrees just within that 1 year. So that was a huge change. And the difference to the time before was that the 2003 marine heat wave was very widespread in the subpolar North Atlantic. Not before small local heat waves, but a widespread large heat wave.
How do you define a marine heat wave in this study? And how can we know area or heat is increasing in recent decades?
So our approach was that we used what is called a high percentile threshold method. So for this purpose, we defined a reference period of normal temperatures. In our case, it was from 1870 to 1969, from which we calculated the so-called 99th percentile. For the subsequent years, we associated a temperature value with a heat wave. If that temperature value exceeded this so-called 99th percentile, that just means that it's a very, very rare event.
And how do we know that heat is increasing in recent decades or that we're getting more marine heat waves?
Well, we are observing much more of these extreme events in recent years. So the year 2003 was kind of the start or the starting bell, how we would say in Germany, to a huge increase in the frequency of marine heat waves, and that is through counting extreme temperature values in different places in the subpolar North Atlantic.
Why are we only discovering the magnitude of a marine heat wave that happened more than 20 years ago? Why now?
Well, because it naturally takes time to measure the stability of the ecological implications. So if we do see ecological changes following a physical extreme event, we need to wait for maybe 10 or 20 years to also be able to say that was, for example, a regime shift or a tipping point. So stability in an ecological change implies more than just 1 or 2 years, and that's why we naturally have to wait to be able to say that we had a tipping point or a regime shift, for example.
After the 2003 North Atlantic heat wave, maybe one study reports a change in cod fishing, others talk about different species across a few different regions. How did you manage to create an overview of the big range of living things, large and small, in the North Atlantic, which is a vast area?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex. Well, we searched the literature. We searched a lot of literature, and we read a lot of papers and looked at a lot of temperature time series and time series of ecological and biological parameters, so distribution of organisms and changes in distribution of organisms. diet composition of organisms. So do we see changes in food web interactions, for example? And we did this with experts from different areas and different taxonomic or functional groups.
Why would a marine heat wave up there affect whales? Can't they just swim to cooler waters if they need to?
So the whales, especially in southeast Greenland, they likely followed the food. So we did see a change in the distribution of the most important forage fish species in the subpolar North Atlantic. It's called capelin. And through larger areas of ice melting in East Greenland, these areas were kind of invaded by capelin, and the whales just followed them. So it was less about too high temperatures for the whales, rather than that areas which were previously ice-covered increased and they got kind of more productive or more attractive for whales, and the whales moved there.
The impacts of the 2003 sea heat did not end in 2003. Can you describe ongoing impacts even a couple of years later or perhaps now?
Thanks, Alex, for this question. This is a difficult question because the factors affecting distribution of these organisms we described, so everything from zooplankton over small fish species, so-called forage fish species, or larger fish species, predatory species like cod or whales, these factors affecting the distribution and, for example, food web interactions, they began to mix over time. So what we see is that 2003 had a huge impact, but after that, the different factors, such as fishing, for example, they started to mix and affect the organisms differently. So, for example, you could see changes after 2003, maybe a decade or two decades, but this was cross-generational. So we had one, for example, in 2003, was a huge cohort, which means a very high survival of fish in the early life stages of haddock in Iceland. But then that large cohort also led to a high adult biomass in the years after, and that occurrence of high adult biomass had, again, other factors, like, for example, density-dependent factors. So it's difficult to disentangle these different factors now, 10 or 20 years after the actual heat wave. But what I can say is that the big picture now is very similar to how it changed in and right after 2003.
If impacts are not all the same for similar ocean extreme events, where does that leave us? I mean, why do you think marine heat waves in the following years, some of similar intensity to 2003, did not result in the same big impacts?
This is a good and a difficult question. So it's mainly speculation, but I personally think that it needs another considerably stronger heat wave to have the same effect again. So most heat waves after 2003 were of smaller or similar magnitude, but the temperatures in the heat waves after 2003 were seldomly higher than in 2003, or they were not as much higher compared to 2003 as 2003 had to the period before. So what I think, but that is speculation, is that it would need another strong and sudden abrupt increase in temperature again to have similar ecological implications to what we saw in 2003. But predicting these ecological changes is very difficult, so I couldn't say what would happen then.
After 2003, you found a drop in zooplankton in the Norwegian Sea, but higher plankton productivity just a little further north. Can we generalize about the 2003 marine heat wave impacts on plankton in the North Atlantic?
So I don't think that a generalization is possible because local conditions are very different in the different places in the North Atlantic. So where we saw a drop in zooplankton biomass, that was in the Norwegian Sea, but at the same time we saw an increase in plankton biomass that was considerably further north. So you called it a little further north, but it's actually around 1,000 kilometers going into the Fram Strait, which is the gate to the Arctic Ocean, where this increase in temperature led to an increase in productivity. So it's difficult to generalize because one always has to look at the very specific local conditions in the different places.
Did the 2003 heat wave change commercial fisheries in the North Atlantic?
Yes, I would say so, to some degree, yes. For example, in East Greenland, the cod fishery started again, which was closed before. And then that was likely because of a very large cohort, which was born or which hatched in the year of 2003. And although it's a bit more difficult to relate it so directly to 2003, also the mackerel fishery, which is a huge fishery in the Northeast Atlantic, was likely related to this rise in the mackerel fishery, or that stock expansion of mackerel, which we saw in the Northeast Atlantic, was also likely related to the heat wave in 2003. So yes, it did have an impact on commercial fishing.
Is it fair to say this 2003 heat wave caused or added to a mass migration of species toward the pole?
So I think we need to disentangle a bit the mechanisms behind the phrase of mass migration or behind this phrase or saying species moving north. So when we say that during these events or with warming species are moving north, that just means that for some species, adults, which can actively swim and they change the distribution, they move north because that's where they find better conditions. But at the same time, species moving north could mechanistically also mean that the survival of the early life stages for fish species, for example, changes for the different populations. So every fish species in the North Atlantic, or usually most of them, have different populations. There are some further north and there are some further south. And what we see is usually that as soon as it gets warmer in the subpolar North Atlantic, which is more ice affected and where we do have more also seasonal ice, that a lot of boreal species, for example, they like these conditions when it gets warmer. And the adults don't necessarily have to move northwards. But what we see is, for example, that in the northern populations, the likelihood of survival in the very early life stages, so eggs and larvae, suddenly increases. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an active migration, how we see, for example, seasonal feeding migrations or spawning migrations of whales or fish, but it could also mean a change in mortality or survival rates of different life stages of these organisms. So I think a mass migration is maybe a bit too strong, but we do see substantial changes, and we did see substantial responses across all of these different life stages. So we saw that adults started to migrate somewhere else, somewhere further north to spawn, for example. They went somewhere and started to prey upon smaller fish. And we did see changes in the survivability of eggs and larvae. So all of these factors started to interact as well.
For too long, we assumed a return to former normal conditions would just restore the collection of life back to the way it was. And we found that wasn't true here in Canada of the North Atlantic cod fishery. After those fish crashed from overfishing, something else took its place. Talk to us about what this means for short, extreme heat events in the sea.
Yeah, that's a good question. And of course, a very valid and valuable observation you mentioned from the Canadian cod stock and the Canadian cod fishery. But it's also, again, a bit difficult to answer. So for the cod fisheries also, as we saw here in front of our own door in the Baltic Sea, for example, when these fisheries and the stock collapsed and it never came back, usually several factors interacted. Not only physical ecological changes in the environment, but also fishing. So when we have these collapses, or when we saw these collapses, and even after one of the stressors was removed and it did not come back to the ecosystem it was before, that means that in the first place, or one factor was that you had deteriorating conditions for cod, and secondly, you also had fishing, and fishing pressure was not adequately removed. And these two things, or the impacts of these two stressors interacted and led to a collapse of the fishery and also to a fundamental change in the ecosystem. For short events, for short extreme events like heat waves, for example, local heat waves, I actually do think that it is different and that these changes can change back. So this is also what we saw, for example, in the Barents Sea to some degree. It doesn't always change back, but if it is just a short physical pulse, I think they could change back. But again, when there are several stresses interacting at the same time, then for me, or what I see, the picture changes.
We have the most data collected on commercial fisheries and less about fundamentals of ocean life, including plankton, but also many species with no apparent value to humans. Where do we need to put more scientists and research money to really know what is going on as we superheat the sea periodically?
I think we need to monitor the ocean. So what we have to do is that, or what the take-home message from that project was, the main take-home message, we need more data. We need more observations of the distribution of different species, of different organisms across all trophic levels, starting from phytoplankton, zooplankton, small fish, up to the huge predators. And we need to monitor regularly their trophic interactions. So we need to see who eats who and how the species change their distribution in response to the environment. And in order to relate changes in distribution and changes in species interactions to the environment, we need to go out with our ships and we need to observe. That is, I think, the most important message I learned from this paper, is that usually when we cannot explain what we see, or we are missing pieces in the puzzle, it is because we don't have biological observations from the environment.
Carl, did the after effects of that 2000 marine heat wave impact Arctic sea life as well?
To some degree, yes, because ice was lost, and if sea ice melts, that usually has a huge impact on the ecosystem, which was formerly covered with sea ice. But in the actual Arctic, which is still ice covered, I don't think so much, because the ice is still there, and the ice is an important driver of everything in the ocean below. And in the Arctic, the ice is still there. So in the core Arctic, up around the North Pole, where we still do have ice, I don't think there were big effects.
Could we call the 2000 marine heat wave in the North Atlantic a tipping point?
Yes, Alex. For many areas in the North Atlantic, this seems to be correct, that we can call this a tipping point.
And there might be more in ocean life in coming marine heat waves. Are there surprises out there as humans cause more global warming?
Definitely, yes. There will be surprises. So the first thing I think we need in the future is to be able to predict heat waves on a physically, so to know when these happen, when they will happen, and how strong they will be. And when we have that, and I think that already is very, very difficult. I'm not a physicist or a physical oceanographer, but I think this is already a huge challenge. And then we can actually try to forecast or to predict or make scenarios about changing in biodiversity or changing in distributions of different organisms. But I think most of the times we will rather be late and look back and see the changes after they actually occurred. And yes, there will be surprises.
A key factor in the supermarine heat wave of 2003 in the North Atlantic was something called the subpolar gyre. It's like a giant whirlpool south of Iceland. It was weak in 2003, letting warmer water from the subtropics into the Norwegian Sea, as I understand it. But was the weak subpolar gyre a result of the ocean heat, or was the ocean heat distributed by the gyre? How does that work?
As far as I understand, it's not resolved yet. So the physical oceanographers are currently arguing about whether the subpolar gyre is the result, or whether changes in the subpolar gyre and the strength of the subpolar gyre are the result of changes in ocean heat content, or if it's the other way around. So if changes in the subpolar gyre strength change ocean heat content. That is currently the discussion, and yeah, it's kind of the old chicken and egg issue. So it's difficult to say what comes first, the change in the subpolar gyre or the change in ocean heat content.
The main body of climate science so far has been collecting facts to create long-term trends, like we make a graph of carbon dioxide over the last 100 years. I think this leaves out an important part of climate change, the impacts of short, severe impacts that may be lost in long averages, but really, really matter. What do you think?
Absolutely correct. So when it comes to ecology, I think these extreme events are actually equally important compared to gradual, slow changes or linear changes. The problem is that the impacts of these short severe events in biodiversity, for example, are much more difficult to predict, as we talked about a few minutes ago, than gradual or long-term changes where you can make assumptions and you can see how, for example, distribution of species or growth of organisms changes. But with these short extreme events, all of these things, or trying to predict ocean life, becomes much, much, much more difficult.
There have been severe heat waves in Europe since the killer heat of 2003. Nowhere near so many people died in later heat waves, though. Society and families adapted. Could that be the case with the ocean mystery, where subsequent ocean heat waves in the North Atlantic did not have the same game-changing impacts?
that's an interesting question. Well, I'm not so sure how, if me as a fisheries ecologist, as I'm allowed to compare organisms in the ocean and humans on land, but maybe there are similar patterns, or maybe there are similar processes taking place. So maybe, yeah, but that is just pure speculation from my side.
Is there anything else you would like to tell us about this new paper or about your current research? Please take as long as you would like. We'd like to hear from you.
Most of the most important points were already mentioned. There were a lot of good questions, and I think we were really able to dive also into the details of what happened. What might be interesting are the future steps, and I think one of the most important lessons or messages out of this paper or future questions is why different heat waves do not affect the ocean in the same way. So we do have heat waves. We did have heat waves after 2003, but they did not have the same impacts as the heat wave in 2003. And we really don't know why yet. And I think that understanding the potential of heat waves to affect ecosystems differently, even in the same place and with a similar magnitude of intense, the ecological implications were different. I think that is the most important future question to answer for us marine ecologists.
From the Thunen Institute of Sea Fisheries in Bremerhaven, Germany, we have been speaking with the research scientist Carl Michael Werner. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog, Wednesdays, at ecoshock.org. Carl, thank you for helping our listeners understand this.
Alex, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you, and thanks a lot for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This new science on the North Atlantic Ocean heat wave of 2003 is part of a new vision and new capabilities entering the climate debate. We start to have data and computer power to investigate particular incidents, events that may only last days, but impacts that last years or longer. Some fast changes are irreversible. This is part of a long-standing debate within science, uniformitarianism versus catastrophism. The founder of the theory of uniformitarianism was Scottish geologist and naturalist James Hutton in the late 1700s. His vision of slow change in rocks over time was much longer than the 6,000 years of the Bible. It revolutionized understanding of Earth's history. Opposing the uniformists is the theory of catastrophism. It suggests Earth's geological features and all things were formed by sudden, violent, and short-lived events, rather than slow uniform processes. This view was raised by the French naturalist and zoologist Georges Cuvier in the early 1800s. Catastrophism has a lot of friends on YouTube, but few in science. But now, short significant events are making a comeback. We don't need to deny the importance of slow changes and global averages over long periods. We just need to add something new, more science of particular spectacular events that leave irreversible changes in following time. The heat wave of 2003 is just such a case. It killed at least 50,000 people in Europe, but also many species in the sea. This may be the best documented case of a combined heat wave on both land and sea. This is new to us. Now it's time for
Radio EcoShock News Bites.
For the first time in human records, mosquitoes reached Iceland. Previously mosquito-free. Too bad. While millions shiver in the Arctic vortex, unstable weather continues in the southern hemisphere. Wildfires in Chile displaced 50,000 people. That was visible from space. Australia got through its monster heat wave, followed by Cyclone Koji in Queensland. To be honest, there has been less extreme in the southern hemisphere overall this year than last. So far, La Niña continues. But we know, day after day, more heat goes into the great southern ocean than comes out. And that's not going to work out well. Back in Europe, it is winter. Storm Henry battered the Mediterranean last week with floods in Italy, Spain, and France. Earlier in January, Storm Goretti has swept the UK with exceptionally strong winds, heavy snow, significant rain, but it's winter. North America got wind chills of minus 40 degrees in the U.S. Midwest and Arctic temperatures and lots of snow in the Northeast. Scientists disagree among themselves whether these incursions of the polar vortex are caused by climate change in the Arctic. There is a snow drought in the West, except for coastal mountains. That may mean water shortages this summer and wildfire conditions for the West. Canadian government forecasters predict 2026 will be another in the latest string of years far hotter than in previous decades. We will see what this new year brings. Insurance losses from natural catastrophes went over $100 billion for the sixth year in a row. That's according to insurance giant Swiss Re. About 83% of those losses were in the United States. The 2025 fires in Los Angeles were the most expensive insured event in world history. Planned obsolescence, remember that? We heard it in the 1960s. Products designed to wear out or break after the warranty expires. That keeps consumers coming back. Return customers, don't you know? Now with trillion-dollar new investments, more coal, oil, and gas, that's planned obsolescence for the whole civilization. Oh, sure, we try to rebuild as fast as things break down, in wave after wave of unnatural instability, until we can't. Don't tell the kids. Snatch what joy we can. Snatch it. Remember to treasure a normal day, old style, even a normal hour. Put love and not waste into the atmosphere around you. Next week, we explore oil power struggles and, why not, AI swarms. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Hi, this is Towers, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC. Diverse, independent, yours.
This is Bird Note. Black-footed albatrosses are masters of the high seas and soar through the air, but their fate is threatened by trouble on land. At their nesting grounds in Midway Atoll in Hawaii, rising sea levels are washing away albatross nests and eggs. But over 3,000 miles away, a surprising rescue operation has been underway since 2021. On Isla Guadalupe in Mexico, Laysan albatrosses were nearly eradicated by feral cats before conservationists intervened in the 1980s. Their successful recovery created a new opportunity, says marine ecologist Julio Hernandez. He is leading an effort to relocate black-footed albatross eggs from Hawaii to the nests of Laysan foster parents in Mexico. But do they notice?
When they hatch, they all look the same, covered in soft gray plumage that helps camouflage chicks.
And when the chicks start showing their true colors?
By then, 4 or 5 months have passed, and there's so much love and care already invested. At that point, they don't care if the chick is black, white, or blue. That's their baby.
Julio says that the Laysan foster parents successfully fledged more than 100 chicks in the first 4 years of the program. After several years at sea, Many of the young black-footed albatrosses are already returning to Isla Guadalupe, which may soon be home to two albatross species who were given a second chance. For BirdNote, I'm Lucina Melesio.